This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
Lots of things have happened in the last handful of days in the David case, and we're going to be breaking them all down, and you are welcome to give us your questions and your thoughts in the comment section as we do so, wherever you are watching us. Please do drop them. Happy Monday, everybody. 4 days of preliminary hearing testimony against David Burke, the singer known as David, have put a mountain of evidence into a Los Angeles court record, and a fourth day was the worst of it. Yeah, we learned so many new things, including about a baby that never came about. Robin Dreek is here, retired FBI Special Agency for the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, to help us break down some of the big questions here and how the defense explains any of it away, because Blair Burke is one of the best defense attorneys in the country, and she needs an answer for every single one of these questions. So let's get into it. One of the big things, the detective read Burke's own message in court, and the one of the text messages said, "When you go and get it done, when W-E-N, you gonna get it done," as he's talking about her ending the pregnancy that she had at the age of 13, and he's an adult. When you know, because you can't, heaven forbid, David be troubled to use full words in a text. It's like when you gonna order Arby's. Really? I mean, does the defense concede, you know, all of these things and just fight the killing? He's a horrible person. He's, you know, completely a little narcissistic monster, which he appears to be. Everything's about him and his image and his money, and he's protecting it at every cost along the way. He's that, but he's not a killer. Is that what you do in a case like this? What do you make of the pregnancy information that's now come to light in this case?
I mean, this is such a broken individual in every aspect. It's been really interesting and terrifying and tragic that defense isn't even covering this aspect of it. You know, the child abuse, the S abuse of a 13-year-old girl. They're lightly seemingly trying to cover and saying he wasn't responsible or, you know, the reason for her death. But it's like they're totally ignoring the other side of which it's just as equal bad. I mean, it's just, there's two sides of him. It's like, I mean, he was brought up, it seems, you know, with zero guardrails. Granted, he seems to be like a five-year-old problem solver. You know, with zero guardrails, accountability, and have we seen in so many cases, he's got this sadistic tinge to him. You know, what is it with human beings that we're the only species on this planet that seems to like sadism, some of us? I mean, just, and he's one of them.
Well, he was brought up in a very religious household. I don't know all the details of it. It's right. Something I do want to dig into deeper, but very religious. Okay. So we're talking, you know, I don't know if it's to the level of IBLP ish, but it seems kind of in that, you know, family, maybe a cousin of it. That sort of extreme religiosity, very rigid thinking, very not attuned to the outside world, until suddenly he starts making music and starts becoming a cash cow. Then it seems mom and dad, you know, maybe some of the extreme religiosity goes out of the way because, well, I mean, your son became a slot machine. Now, that's my conjecture. That's my opinion as I'm looking at this from the outside. Obviously, the inside is very, very different. And I'm telling you now, I don't know all the details of how this all went. But just on the outside looking in, which could be wrong, it looks like, you know, some of the very strict guardrails went away very quickly. And we know something about human beings. When they're held back and they're restrained over here and not shown what's behind door number two or the outside world, and suddenly they're there, that can be a very jarring thing. I'm not trying to make any excuses for David here. I'm trying to figure out the recipe for David here. And I'm wondering, and I'm curious to get your thoughts of how much an upbringing, an extremely sheltered upbringing that went from that to this. I mean, it does seem like there was some sort of, you know, very traumatic shift very quickly. And that might have just been fame. That might have, the trauma in David's world might have been fame of suddenly going from very sheltered to suddenly you're this artist that's making all this macabre music that probably does not necessarily adhere to your family's religious, you know, testimonies of everything that you've known. So very jarring, very different, but that also throws people's compasses, I would say, very off balance as well, because they don't know how to act. What are your thoughts on that whole premise, Robin?
Yeah, I give it a big dose of the maybes on that one, because we do see, I mean, it's easy if we want to just have a binocular or monocular looking right at cases just like this that go sideways, or someone goes from, you know, strict religious or just a strict background in general to having freedoms or wealth or basically going from zero to 100 and it going sideways, and we've seen horrendous things. But at the same time, though, you can see other cases where it doesn't. You know, I mean, every time I think of him, I think of like Katy Perry. You know, Katy Perry grew up, you know, her dad was a pastor. Granted, it's apples and oranges in some cases, but here's someone that grew up singing gospel music and was, you know, in a very religious household, and she made it big, and she didn't go nuts. I mean, granted, you know, in some people might say nuts, but no, she's successful. She's doing well. She hasn't killed anyone or been accused of killing anyone, you know, and so people do make that adjustment. It's a rough adjustment. And I think the other thing that really pops in my mind is, who are all these people surrounded by when that shift happens? Because that's what I think really, really makes a difference. You know, we have our genetic and biological coding, and people are predetermined in some cases that, you know, if you are lacking empathy, you are, you know, on that psychopathy scale. It is a scale that goes from, you know, zero all the way up to 100, or all the way up to Lori Daybell Vallow, right? Yeah. And people are on that scale someplace. But if you're predisposed to one end of it where you lack empathy, and then you surround yourself with really unhealthy people that are motivated by greed, because I think that's the other major motivator we keep talking about, where there's all these guardrails growing up and all of a sudden greed kicks in, whether it's with parents or the sycophants that have surrounded you, that greed kicks in and you start turning that blind eye, and all of a sudden there are no guardrails. People, you know, just think about Diddy. Diddy, there's no guardrails on him either. And what happens? People just start feeding that narcissism. And if you have lack of empathy, higher on psychopathy, you have no guardrails, you have greed kicking in, your sycophants around you are feeding it. You know, it's another bucket of genetic goo of chaos. And that's where, yeah, I think it really fell on this one. I think it's unusual, but not as unusual as we might want to hope, because I think he was a product of being made as much as he was genetics as well. I really do.
Yeah, I think you got a good mix going on. And we're going to get more into who David was prior to all of this in our next segment. I didn't mean to go too far down that road, but I led us there. You know, but it is something I want to dive more into a little bit further in the conversation. So please be dropping your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. And by the way, if you're watching us on YouTube, up over there, there's a QR code now. You can take us with you on the go, by the way. So if you want to listen to the podcast beyond just YouTube, please do. Just go to the QR code and then it'll take you to a place where you can subscribe anywhere you get podcasts. So it's a kind of a nice little extra way to take us with you. What did you make of this? His phone, because we're learning so many little things about David through these text messages that have come out, and aspects of his phone. Allegedly, his phone lock screen, at the time of arrest down the road here, his phone lock screen was a photo of them embracing. I don't know what to make of that. I mean, if you know that the world is looking at you as possibly being the killer of this young girl, and you're you're telling people that you don't have, that he told police, oh, I don't barely know her, you know, or whatever he said when they came in and talked to him. It was just very like nonchalant. I don't know much about her. Obviously not true. But he was free for damn near at least more than half a year from the investigation of this starting. And everybody, when we started talking about it, he was a free man. And she's still on the lock screen of you guys embracing. They had the matching tattoos and all that. Obviously, her fingers were cut off that had the matching tattoos on it. What do you, Robin, as a behavior person, what's your take on that? That allegedly up to the point of, you know, them confiscating his device, the lock screen is a picture of the two of them.
I think it could, like many things, I think it could be many things. When it comes to him, my first thought always is lazy idiot.
Yeah.
Because I think that plays into it. His lack of understanding of how investigations go, the criminal code, what right and wrong is, obviously. I mean, his immaturity as a human being is so bottomed out that I think a lot of it's that. But the other thing that really struck me too, and as a possibility that's sprinkled in here, because I think it's never just one thing. It's like we said, you throw all the goo in the bucket and it's, this is what you wind up with. And we talked about this when dealing with Asa Ellerup and Rex, yeah, and all these other nutters out there. I'd be very curious. Oh, and also, what's her face? That, you know, the children's book's name, Corey Richens.
Yeah.
You know, people define love, can define love very, very differently. And I'm very curious about that with him, because if he, in other words, how does a sadistic psychopath like him, I'll define him as that for now for
yeah,
thought experiment's sake, how does he define love? Maybe that was very loving to him. I mean, who knows? See what I mean? I mean, who knows? Because their way of thinking is so incongruent with a behavioral pattern of normal human beings that it's really hard to say. You know, it could be that. It could be how he defines things. I think the predominance of it is pure stupidity because he's a complete idiot. But at the same time, he might have even been thinking, it's like, well, why bother? I did so many of the dumb things, but this is just like one more sprinkle of all the crap I just put on the ice cream cone for myself.
And it's interesting to think about in that discussion. I mean, how does he define love? How do we define love, Robin? I mean, is that something that comes to us? And it's a good question for Siobhan too. But from a behavior standpoint, from what you understand, I mean, is that something that comes more so from what we have demonstrated to us in childhood, from our parents demonstrating love and caring to us, and what they define as love to us? Because what one may define as love, or walk out of that house going, oh, this is love, and it's very rigid and it's very conditional and it's very restrictive. But if that's all you know, and that's what you think love is because that's what was demonstrated to you, that's what you're going to practice. But if it's not that, if it's giving, if it's forgiving, it's caring, it's something other than that, then that will be your definition of love too. It's a lot about what is conditioned to us, is yeah, it not? I mean, I'm trying to get more to the meat here or the recipe, the ingredients of what made David. And we'll go more into our second segment. But I do wonder about that. How much does, look, most very religious households, very rigid, very conditional in your thinking and their demonstrations of love to one another. It is. I know it should be the opposite if you're thinking of what truly the Bible is about and Jesus and all that. But that's not how it's practiced in most cases. In most cases, it's very rigid and very conditional in those sort of thinkings. So, I mean, it does kind of track to a certain extent.
So it's, this is such a great deep question, and you're right, depends on the context in which you grow up in. In general, so let's just think about this. All the motivations of us as a species is fear. Fear,
yeah,
drives our reactions to everything. And so things that allowed us to feel safe at those earlier formative years of life are the things that we want to have and continue to want to have the rest of our lives. And so if we have good, healthy relationships, because that is how we can mature through the life arc of a human being, is good, healthy, strong relationships that allow us to feel safe, those are the things we're going to pursue for the rest of our lives. How that's demonstrated to us during those early formative years is really, really telling to what we're going to be seeking the rest of our lives. A lot of times, when we're seeing demonstrated with a lot of these abhorrent, you know, bags of goo that we see, is that control becomes the thing they need to have to feel safe. And for so say, and again, for pure conjecture reasons here in a thought experiment, say because he was in such a controlled environment, that's what allowed him to feel safe or maybe unsafe. And so when control was exercised against him, maybe he didn't feel safe. And so in order to feel safe for the rest of his life after he broke away from that, he needs his only memory he has for human interaction is control, which a lot of psychopaths do. A lot of people do. Control freaks. I mean, we've seen this in so many of our cases. That's what Corey Richens, you know, when we talked to Siobhan about it, she defined love as her ability to control her kids, control her environment, control her husband, control absolutely everything and everyone. Because that, yeah. And because what's control do? It allows us to feel safe. A lot of people define that as love. I saw a good podcast the other day, and they're asking, a Buddhist monk, are you happy? And he goes, that's a really interesting question, because what is really happiness? And happiness is really just a state of peace. And what brings about peace? A feeling of safety. And so that's what we're really all pursuing as a species. We want to feel safe because that allows us to have peace. Homeostasis is what we're seeking when we don't have all the strifes and challenges that we face on a daily basis. And so during the formative years of life, if you start defining that feeling of safety, I need control for whatever reason that developmentally hit, that's how these things, again, get added to that bucket of goo.
I feel like that question, are you happy? I don't like it ever because
it's a horrible one.
Because and happiness is a temporary thing. Are you fulfilled? I like that. Are you, because that fulfillment is not necessarily something that comes and goes in very quick waves. Happiness does. Happiness can be a very blip. Fulfillment is more of a wave that either goes up or down. And if you're a fulfilled person, you're not necessarily doing crazy shit because you're good where you're at. And I think so many, we're in a world where we chase this happiness bug or what we think should be happiness. And then so many people end up not fulfilled and they're truly chasing fulfillment, but they're trying to fill it with happiness and happiness is fleeting.
Because then why is it fleeting? Yeah. It's a dopamine hit.
Yeah,
because happiness, I mean, again, I sound like an armchair psychologist. I'm sorry.
We are today.
So happiness really happens when we feel happy. What's going on in the brain? We're having a dopamine hit. And what creates a dopamine hit? Because we set a goal and objective. We achieved the goal and objective or that finish line. We cross the finish line. But as soon as we cross the finish line, we get the dopamine hit and the dopamine fleets. And so we need to do another dopamine. That's how people get addicted because we like things that give us dopamine hits. Sometimes it can be healthy. Sometimes they're unhealthy. Yeah. And so control, if we exercise control over someone and they become compliant, it's a dopamine hit. I mean, we saw fear being used to control with what's-her-face, you know, that killed her friends. Yeah. The teenager that's in jail. I can't believe I'm blanking everyone's name. Yeah. You know, but she drove 100 miles an hour into the wall because she's using Charilla fear as a form McKenzie. Of control because... Yeah. That made her feel safe. Again, it's the same thing. It keeps repeating itself.
It is. And when you're following that in life and you're following little blips, little things to make you happy real quick, you tend to follow that in other things. Little quick ways to fix temporary solutions. Everything in life becomes a Band-Aid. Like 11 air fresheners in the car where you have a body in the trunk. Like somehow that's going to fix it. Oh, I mean, again, that's a prime example where it's like happiness, quick little spike of happiness here, quick little solution over here. Like it ain't going to fix your problem. It's going to smell like shitty air freshener Christmas tree for a few minutes with the slight undertone of decay. But, you know, the air freshener might win for a day or two. But I mean, that's the way of thinking. I mean, when you see someone demonstrate that level of stupidity, I don't know any other way to call it, just wear the dunce cap every day if you're putting 11 air fresheners in your car to hide the scent of a decaying body, and somehow thinking, oh, this will solve the problem. There's not many good problem-solving skills in existence in that person's brain.
No, it's very reactionary, and I don't know what the prosecutors are going to try to go for when it comes to premeditation on this, but when I see things like that, that's not premeditation. That's the level of premeditation is so light because... But it's very typical of someone who never had to really struggle to solve a serious problem in life because you solved it as it came up. And since you have no life skills and actually facing something like bad odors, you know, it's kind of like, I know you got a teenager now, but I remember my kids, you know, it took a while to teach them that, you know, when they were younger or any of their friends, that the way you take a shower is not getting up in the morning and take a whole bottle of Axe and just spraying it all over yourself and that counts as a shower. No, that is a fucking, Band-Aid for bad hygiene. Yeah. It's the same thing here. So when I saw all the air fresheners, it just reminded me of a teenager or preteen with really, really no habits of how to encounter life on a daily basis because they had everything taken care of for them. And so when you have everything taken care of for you, such structure and rigidity, now remember, structure and rigidity doesn't necessarily mean that you were controlled. It just meant everything was planned so you didn't have to solve problems. You didn't have to face something and figure out what to do next. You didn't have to face an obstacle in the road and figure out how to get around it because the structure and rigidity that mom and dad gave me solved the problem for me. And then all of a sudden he goes from zero to having to solve own problems to, oh my God, I killed someone or someone got pregnant or someone is saying that she's going to go to the law enforcement and say that I was underage. And all of a sudden you go from zero problem solving to this problem solving. And so... this is what you wind up with. Stupid.
You sure do. You sure do. I mean, I feel at the end of the day, like both of these people were failed spectacularly by their parents. And it's just like, it's the patients are running the asylum.
And every adult in their lives. I mean, so David, it's not like he's just surrounded by a bunch of other 18-year-olds that are actually running his business. I couldn't be. I mean, how could... someone in the industry which promoting him, going to concerts. I mean, there's got to be other adults in here, right? I mean, we're going to hear about him in the trial. Even if you shove the parents out there and you say the parents didn't create the guardrails, surely someone who's actually in the greed business, which is what they are, you know, you have a product, you have greed, and so you're going to do all you can to make money. You're going to create the guardrails for them so they don't do stupid so you can keep making your money. But they failed on that level, too.
The music industry isn't very good at that. The music industry is a little more like, don't disturb the cash machine. And when the cash machine dies, set it afire and throw it out the window and pretend we never had it here.
Tesla.
Yeah, throw it because I mean that's music industry in general. When something like questionable happens, it's just get rid of it, don't deal with it. It's like okay, we've milked it for all we can, but don't disturb it. Let it self destruct. They're not good at maintaining general maintenance, if you will, on their artists and such. And that's why so few ever seem to have longevity because they fall to not that murdering people is a temptation, but the temptations of the excess of that world, and then it can go down very dark places. And if you already have a propensity to go down those sort of roads, well, then it's that much easier. And I wonder if that's what's going on here with David. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Links are in the description. Let's go to our next piece of our conversation here. Before the charges, before the fame, before anyone outside a Fortnite lobby knew his name, it's because that's what he did early on. He played Fortnite and became famous playing Fortnite. Amazing what you can do these days. David Burke was a homeschooled kid from a church-going family recording songs on an iPhone in his sister's closet. 4 years later, he had a record deal. A billion streams. And prosecutors allege a 14-year-old girl's body in the trunk of his Tesla. Robin Dreek is with us as we continue to trace the line. The retired FBI Special Agency for the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. Gospel music only until age of 13, homeschooled after seventh grade. His whole social world was online, gaming lobbies and streams. When a kid grows up that isolated from real-world consequences. What doesn't get built in a person when that happens?
I think just all we can do is have some conjecture on it, because I'm interacted with a lot of people like this, and they're I wouldn't say they're super well adjusted, but who actually is super well adjusted, but adjusted well enough to not do this kind of stupid shit.
Yeah.
Again, I just think it's a lack of their own personal moral compass, because a moral and ethical compass, I think, because that upbringing was imposed on them, but there obviously wasn't any buy into it. So yeah. I still think this is a balance in him of genetics as well as nature and nurture together, because it's hard. There's knowledge is put in there, and I can't think it was the old adage, you know, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. But all you can do is hope to make the horse thirsty to make them interested to want to drink. And I think that's what was lacking here. He just wasn't interested in healthy boundaries, healthy lifestyle, healthy relationships. It wasn't ever demonstrated in some way, or maybe it was, because I don't want to bash the parents. We don't know much really about them, except that they...
Their decision-making abilities.
You're right.
Their demonstrated choices is what we know.
Yeah. And so I guess the question is, how far does the apple fall from the tree on that one? And I just don't know, because he is very broken on very many levels, obviously.
I mean, there's a lot of, you know, obviously different types of, you know, and I'm not art out there, dark, melancholic, ironic. You know, and his music kind of hit that tone of sad person music, if you will. Sad R&B, dark R&B. He even invented an alter ego called Itami, pain in Japanese, an agent of chaos who commits murders. His other self investigates. Ooh, how deep. I mean, obviously, people are young, they're creative. Creative types are going to create all different sort of things. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with doing that. But I guess what makes it creepy is all the signs were here. The fact that he had created a alter ego that's an agent of chaos, then commits murders as the alter ego, and then self-investigates. He does it through art and his music videos. Literally bodies in trunks, a bloody knife, playing a killer and a victim. I mean, what is the line here between dark art and rehearsal? And do you think he went into, I guess it's this chicken before the egg I'm trying to get to. Was this, you know, a world where he thought, you know, this is the path he's going to go down and actually kill somebody? Or did the art inspire him to do something like this? It's like, well, I've done this in a video. I guess maybe I could do it in real life. Where do you think the line was crossed here of this is the best choice for me at this moment in time is to remove this other person from the planet, allegedly, if he did it, versus just, you know, do art that is very macabre and dark. I mean, many people do macabre art and never murder anybody.
Yeah, but it definitely gives you a pause when there's a wobble from what you typically expect from someone at a certain age level, the way they're interacting with the world, the type of relationships they're having. And so when you see a wobble from what you're expecting a normal, healthy behavior to have, you kind of zero in on it. And then you explore it, you know, and I'm saying the parents in his life, the responsible adults in his life, and you kind of see if there's more there. In cases like this, I mean, again, from the outside looking in, from the limited data we have, although we have a lot more on this case than most cases, you're seeing someone who is fantasizing about dark things, dark art, dark murders, you know, court. I mean, just the whole genre is very, very dark and violent. And so when you start seeing fantasies about that, because obviously you have to have a fantasy if you're going to create art about it, because you're thinking about it, you're imagining it. I can only imagine it desensitizes you. I know it does. I don't have to imagine. It does desensitize you towards those things. Then when you consume more data, you consume more information, you consume more art around the same genre, because that could be inspiring to you. It just completely flattens out any affect you have when you see these types of things. So when you have a problem arise, like the girlfriend who's going to report you about, you know, dating and doing more horrendous things to someone who's underage, your mind can naturally go to the problem solving that you've been desensitized to. Well, I'll just do this because why not? Because this is what I've seen work before in this fantasy world I'm living. So I from what we see, premeditated early on to take care of her like this, don't think so, because they had a relationship, they got matching tattoos, they did all those other things. But as a problem solving skill set that he had, that looks like it was probably it.
Yeah, I mean, it's such an extreme to go to, but not for him. Yeah, I don't know that he saw another way out. And honestly, there really wasn't. I mean, there was no way out. Unless she didn't, you know, expose him for what he was, but then he'd have to be accountable for his what he's done.
And you look at the motivation again. It goes back to fear. What did he fear? He feared exposure. And the way you counter that fear is control. I'm going to control the narrative. I'm going to control her. The only way I'm going to control her, again, innocent until proven guilty, I'm going to get rid of the problem. And since he's been desensitized, to him, that was not extreme. If you just are surrounded yourself by that kind of chaos and that kind of dark art where death is a way of life, a way of viewing things, unhealthy relationships is, it's not extreme for him from his context to say, that's how I'm going to solve this problem. I'll eradicate the problem because I have fear. Fear is our motivator. Fear was his motivator.
Prosecutors say he met Celeste when she was 11. He was still in high school, which is still very nuts. Deputies flagged it in 2024, a label management, the whole machine invested in him. Why do you think nobody stepped in? Do you think at the end of the day, I mean, this is just conjecture, the label's not on trial, the family's not on trial, the friends aren't on trial. I know the quick excuse is always, well, she said she was older than she was, and she looked a little bit older than she was. I think that's up for debate. There's some photos where she looks very much like the age that she is. There's some where she doesn't. This person in this orbit is going around. There's people who had to book plane tickets. Those sort of things require ages and IDs and information, and they have to match up. So I just don't buy this idea that absolutely no one had no idea how old she was. The question is, were they ever going to say anything about it, or were they just going to continue to do what the music industry always does? We're just going to hope nothing bad happens. And eventually this will blow over. She'll go off into the ether. He'll move on. And then, you know, X amount of years later, it'll be a Mick Jagger story or a Steven Tyler type story,
right,
where it's like, well, then everybody's like, well, and people look the other way because people are sick. But it makes you wonder, what was the game plan here? Because he's the cash cow. Don't disturb the cash cow.
Yeah.
Was that the simplicity of it? And it just went horribly wrong. And now everything's come back to roost. And the people who were like, we were hoping this was going to blow over, now have to answer for not doing or saying anything.
Yeah. I think it's really that simple. I don't think it's really complicated. I don't think there's a big high thinkers going on here where they fear, again, the fear motivator on this one, they fear losing the cash cow, their way of life. And with the hope, again, when you hang your hat on hope that she'll eventually age out of being underage, well, we'll just wait a little while. Just turn my head a little bit this way. And to one of the viewers' comments about, you know, what did they fear? Because everyone in the circle knew it. I think if I was her, it wasn't her saying to the entourage that I'm underage. It's her saying, I'm going to go to law enforcement and say I'm underage. That's a whole different kind of fear that then jumps into everyone's mindset, especially if it's his, because he can control their narrative by the fear is, I will kick you out of the cash cow.
Mm-hmm.
And so And it can be very unwritten. I mean, that's what Diddy did all the time. So I think this is just that same kind of very simple, very basic. People don't want to rock the boat, keeping things as is, keeping them status quo. And she did something that was out of the norm of what was going on, of what she threatened to escalate it towards, I got to take action.
I'm a little surprised, honestly. I'm not saying this is the right answer, but I'm a little surprised that there wasn't, if she's making these sort of threats of exposure, I'm guessing he didn't go anywhere with it. I'm guessing he didn't communicate this to anybody, that there were these threats that she was going to expose him. Because my guess would be that if there had been adults in the room, and again, not saying that these would be great thinking adults, but adults in the room who have some experience in the music industry, there might have been thoughts of, can we write her a check and have her shut up?
Yeah. You would have thought that they would have just kicked that someone, if he actually had a handler that was actually handling him, yeah, she would have been kicked out long ago.
Yeah. And I don't think any of that was going on. No. I mean, he was an indie artist. He didn't necessarily have the apparatus of like a Diddy or anything like that. He was nowhere near that level. So I do wonder how much was really being handled strictly by him. And because that's most of it.
Yeah, my guess is it's all him. So let's look at that life arc before that. So say you have, again, our conjecture on this one from what we know, you have controlling parents, you got a controlling situation in life where it's been controlled for you and you're rebelling against control. And so finally, when you do get control, there's going to be a visceral reaction to anyone trying to control him or handle him. And so if you're because I'm just thinking about this. This actually plays into exactly what I think played out here, is that say someone in that entourage started to say something or say, hey, what's going on with Celeste over here? She seems to be a little underage. Maybe you might want to rethink this. Well, that sounds an awful lot like a parent who's been trying to control him his whole life. So what's he going to do? Boof.
Push him out, yeah.
Yeah. And so how did people get silence? Because if you try to exercise control or give your thought or opinion, which was against his, which was what his life arc maybe to this point has been, you're going to get rid of them and just say, you're done with the cash cow.
Yeah, I mean, that is true. I mean, it's a lot of conjecture, but people who tend to have been controlled heavily early on in their life that then get their taste of freedom, they are very quick to reject any form of control, even if it truly is in one's best interest, not just someone's religiosity, extremism that they're trying to push onto somebody for their agenda. They're just going to flat out reject anything. But first, people need to say something. I guess that's where we're at. Is like, did anybody even go there? Not just like didn't go there because they knew that David would kick them out of their lives. I mean, like, look at Michael Jackson. I mean, that's someone who, there was plenty of people in that world who told him, this was not a good idea. Don't do this. Don't do that. It's not a great idea to sleep with kids in your bed, even if you're not doing anything with them. And I'm not going into Diddy or Diddy. But he pushed every single person out of his world who gave him good advice of like, this is not acceptable shit to be doing if you don't want to be liable. I wonder how much of that was at play here too, with him being young and dumb, as well. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of questions there.
Yeah, and I want to add another little thing in here. I think also plays into it. Also, as human beings, we typically don't believe someone's going to do something very horrendous very often at all, unless they, I mean, how many times, you know, when someone says, all right, there's been a murder over in this area, everyone be on the lookout, right? People put in their mind what they're going to be on the lookout for. They're going to be looking for some sleazy, greasy guy that looks like a murderer. No. I mean, it's very rarely that case because we have a conjecture of what it is. In other words, you have what's called primacy. You give yourself your own confirmation bias on what you're going to see or not see. And typically people don't expect someone who is likable and they like, because again, when I've seen him and doing interviews and stuff, he's a likable kid.
Yeah.
And so when you put likability and you put success, you put problem solving and you put the cash cow all into one bucket, people's thought process on he's going to fix a problem by killing someone is probably not on the forefront of their mind that that could ever possibly happen, because likable, nice people don't do that. And so I think that also played into the reason why people didn't come forward. Plus, again, they wouldn't even, I'd imagine it wasn't like he'd be controlling his environment around him just in one area. He probably leaked all the time, I got this, I'm in control, I'm managing everything because I'm successful. I made all the money and I did it all on my own. Because even on his mother's one statement, you know, with the Fortnite thing or with the writer's strike, I think it is, she said, and you probably know the question better than me or the statement, it's like she said, hey, you know, don't worry about the writer's strike, write your own music. So you have that early problem-solving skill set that he built early on. And then when you have control, you don't like outside input. People know, don't give him outside input, because who am I to argue? Look at all the success he's had. So kind of it keeps piling in that bucket of stupid goo.
It wasn't writer's strike. It was copyright strikes.
That's right. That's what it was.
On material that he was using on YouTube. So he decided to make his own. And my God, I mean, if you're, you know, a parent or something, or you're the person who's doing it, you're like, okay, I'll just make my own. That's something to be proud of. Holy crap. You're not relying on like third party stuff. That's like, there was like, this is, I just feel like this is one of those cases where this is a brain that has very savant like problem solving skills in certain areas and zero to none in others, which is very common amongst very creative types. It's how the brains work. It's not super shocking, but it is also usually the downfall of characters like this. And he's just one of many in history at the end of the day. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we continue to discuss the David case and where it all continues to go. Let's go to another case. 16 children ages 18 months to 18 years were removed from a house in Hamden, Ohio on June 30th. Four adults, the parents and the grandparents, are each charged with 16 counts of endangering children, and all four have pled not guilty. The attorney general called what they saw pure evil. The defense says it's poverty. Joining me, Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, and has spent a career reading why people do what they do. And we welcome your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we break this down. Elizabeth Siders, your attorney, says this is a case of poverty and isolation, not evil. I don't know. I've seen a lot of folks in poverty, close-up, and somewhat isolation, and they ain't putting 16 kids in a single room packed with animals and feces. That's not poverty. They're saying evil requires malice. Well, choosing to do that and walking in that room every day and seeing children like that, that would be called malice. Poverty doesn't teach a family to move across counties and leave no school or medical records for 20 years. Where does this all break down? How much of it is just poverty, and how much of this is depraved behavior that was normalized?
Yeah, let's go poverty round first. Yeah. And having grown up with not much, not nearly as little as they had, but very not much, and knowing a lot of people living in poverty and doing a lot of studies on it, poverty can account for many things, but not these choices, because that's what the defense is going to want to say on this, but it's not the case at all, because the second part of that is what is really the cruel part and the really telling part is the isolation. Isolation's a choice, especially these days. And so then you ask yourself, what is the reason for the isolation? People isolate out of fear. Now, fear can be generated because of shame. It can be generated out of embarrassment, or you're trying to hide something. When you look at the circumstances, and I did the research on this, when you're hiding something at this level, when you have 16 kids, you have a conjoined twins that die, you have and remember, there's isolation where you don't want to interact with the world, and then you have confinement where everyone's put into a room that they're not allowed out in, and it's, again, like you said, feces, excrement, you name it. It was horrendous in there. The things that are typically hidden is abuse. Mm-hmm. And then the S abuse probability, very, very high. There's a lot of different abuse that's going on here. That is the general, if we're looking at laws of probability and research and profiling, the reason for isolation in cases like this is to hide abuse because of fear of being exposed. And so poverty, to me, it doesn't play nearly as much as the hiding of abhorrent behavior, and it's all a very conscious choice.
I also wonder, you know, how much drugs played into this as well. Not that it's an excuse, but I saw somebody make the comment, like, if the Duggars were on meth... Yeah, probably. Yep. I mean, honestly, like if that had somehow creeped into their ecosystem and like slowly took over all of them, it's probably about what you'd see here is something like this.
This is Duggars without IBLP.
Yeah, without IBLP and a lot of meth. It's like just mix that in there and see how dramatically that ingredient changes the recipe for what we're seeing and like what the finished product is coming out of the oven from hell. Elizabeth Siders was 15, 7 months pregnant when a judge and both sets of parents signed off on her marriage. 17 years later, she's charged with 16 counts. Obviously, there's the question, can a person be shaped into something and still be responsible for it? Let's start there.
Yeah, society says yes. The law says yes. You can, and this is always that interesting balance. You can have great empathy where it is you understand what made them, but just because you understand the abhorrent situation and generational chaos and generational unhealthy things doesn't mean it's not an excuse for still making a choice to do those things. Because just as many cases as there are like this, there's just as many cases of people that are able to escape that as well because they're making choices. Because the law still is the law. You can't do this. There is no excuse. And because, I mean, just look at the case we're facing with the mom in the Northeast, you know, with battling because the level of trying to get someone to be able to claim insanity for their actions is so high because it still comes down to, do they know the difference between right and wrong?
Yeah.
Yes. And no matter what excuse you want to make, well, I'm in poverty, I'm on drugs, I'm on meth, whatever it is, you're still making a choice to do abhorrent things to your children and raise them in the way that you didn't need to raise them. So they're making a choice to keep their kids locked in a house with no exposure outside and not clean up, not even sweep the crap out of there. I mean, just that's all a choice, 100% choice.
I see a question in the comments, and it's the one part of the question I wanted to ask on that same thing. What do you think about the mother knowing about the relationship? At some point, the parents signed off on their 15-year-old pregnant daughter marrying, you know, Dumble Bumblefuck over here. You know, it's what do I think? I mean, I think it's abhorrent. I think the parents of Siders failed them horrendously. Of Elizabeth failed her horrendously. The bullshit of, well, it's, you know, it is generational. It is. I mean, I get it. I mean, there's that part of the world where it's almost like a third world, the hills have eyes type country. And we seem to like be okay with that as a society. Well, it's just how they've always done things. Maybe they shouldn't. Maybe, you know, if they're reproducing, there's new people coming in here. It's not just like older generations that are from some other place in time. Isn't this neat? We're going in and viewing living history. No, they keep reproducing. And then these children are being tortured and going through absolute hell in Appalachia. And we're just like, well, to each their own. It's their culture. It's how they're doing shit. Yeah, maybe they shouldn't. Maybe we're a better society than that. Maybe we should be stepping in and going, yeah, you know, no more of this, or you can't have, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I what's your take?
Yeah, I definitely agree that there's a lot of generational stupid going on here, but at the same time, again, the stats on this are pretty solid. Also, they were able to confirm that she indeed is the mother of those kids. But they haven't done genetic coding. Now they put a gag order that we won't know until the trial who's the father. That I think we're going to see a wild ride potentially. And I think that's why a lot of this is silence. Remember, people go into isolation because of fear of exposure. If you're just raising, I mean, think about this. If you are, again, I've read two, three, four books on this, plus my own research on the side. I mean, if you are raising a family, you're impoverished, you are food insecure, there are programs for that if you have 16 kids. You know, it's doable without going into isolation. You know, that is a choice. Going into isolation and hiding things is a choice. And, you know, and there's a reason why you don't want to. And so that's where the wobble exists. So, because you can look across a wide swath of people that are living below the poverty level and not see this. And so the reason why this gets the attention, because there's a wobble, because they're making an intentional choice to hide something that their fear of exposure of, what is that? And that's where I think we're going to see coming out in this trial.
You know... You know, you said food insecure. I hate politically incorrect terms. they're starving, is what they are.
Sure.
And you know, like not how they had a home. They're not housing insecure, whatever the hell people call it. They were living in squalor and they were starving their children. Mm-hmm. That's what it was. It wasn't food insecure. I feel like when we whitewash shit so much, and this is not a dig on you by any means. I'm just saying, like, people, the society in general, how we talk about shit, where it's like, it feels like, I don't think the impact is made with people that could make choices to step in and do something, because it's like, oh, you're food insecure. Well, that means there's just a pantry down the road, or you can get this, like... They're starving. Let's put it that way. The dumb fuck parents decided not to feed the kids and lock them in a room. Mm-hmm. That's not food insecure.
Right.
That's depraved starvation of 100%. Human beings. That's a concentration camp, basically.
Yep.
I feel like it's such a disservice on cases like this when the shit is played down to be politically correct. I fucking hate it. And I hated that, you know, like we have to do that with YouTube too and some things. But do you think that makes people not fully understand the dark level that some people in our society live in, the dark world that they encounter every single day because we've chosen safer words now to use for the last 10, 20 years than what reality actually is? So if they're not seeing it daily, they're like, holy shit. I remember like going to like Jackson, Mississippi for the first time. Holy fucking shit. It's a third world country. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know it was that bad. I didn't know how bad half of the South was. It's like a third world country because they didn't see it every day. But it's phrased in ways to the rest of society that doesn't see it on a daily basis as, oh, it's, you know, it's this or it's that. And it's kind of, you know, colloquialism. And it's just, you know, isn't this dandy? Like, no, it's a fucking squalor. It's disgusting. It's horrible. And people are dying and being abused. But that's not as cute as saying, hey, stop on over to get some Mayhaw jelly at the stand on the side of the road.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of reasons why the phraseology in there, I see it a lot on shows we see on TV, watching the news, and just in everyday life, where we don't want to shame people for choices that aren't theirs. And so we pick nicer words so there's no shame in there. And also, I see this predominantly, we probably see it more, Tony, because we cover cases like this, where everyone, so the general population, or a lot of the population, not the general, right, they think everyone is savable.
Yeah.
No, there's really some people out there that are just really an important bucket of goo that are not savable because they're genetically and biologically just so broken and so sadistic and so self-serving and all these things that go in there that they're just making horrendous choices and they are not savable. They need to be behind bars. They need to have kids taken away from, but not put into a system that's already broken. So it's just so many broken things in this thing.
Yeah.
But yes, people use the softer language to make themselves feel better, to not shame people because they don't want to shame people because if you just don't shame people, they won't make bad choices.
That's not how it works.
I know it's not how it works. And we know it's not how it works because we cover a lot of, I mean, just look at, you know, we just covered David. DVD, you know, he's made choices because he's an abhorrent, sadistic human being.
Feel like when we, I mean, like, I'm not about, like, let's go bully and shame people, but like, to make it, like, life, like, abhorrent choices to be a lifestyle choice is not helping anyone. You know, I mean, and I get like probably Elizabeth and, you know, her sperm donor that she called her husband or whatever the hell he was, you know, was also, you know, they were brought up with these monsters. Mm-hmm. So, but then probably entered somewhat of a society that says, oh, isn't that quaint? Isn't this is how the Appalachian lifestyle is. This is who we are. These are our people. This is what, like, yeah, you should have some shame there because this is disgusting. And this is not, there's nothing good about this.
No, I mean, do something about it.
Something should be done so people don't have to continue to live in the abhorrent conditions. I can guarantee the first generations that lived in the abhorrent conditions weren't like, gee, I hope my great-great-great-grandchildren keep this tradition going. I'm sure they were like, I hope for something better. And at some point, the generations are like, this is what we do. It's like, no, it shouldn't be. This isn't good. This isn't healthy. This isn't helpful to anyone. This is disgusting for your poor children who are coming up. And shame is a motivating factor that can sometimes move things along. But I just wonder how much we've just normalized as it's a lifestyle choice. Like people who live under the bridge, like it's somehow like they're a fucking protected species or some sort of shit. Like, no, they're mentally ill and they need help. It's probably addiction. And they need help. They're not fucking there because they're having a jolly old time and homelessness is a fun fucking thing for them. But right. we end up protecting ourselves by giving different words to shit rather than dealing with what reality actually is.
And even on this case too, there's so many choices that weren't made that could have been made. So say you were starving.
Yeah.
And not just food insecure, starving. So the school systems themselves, so why did they keep their kids out of school then? I mean, my wife's a teacher, you know, your wife, same thing. You know, there are school lunch programs at least to try to provide nutrition for kids throughout the school year, even during the summers. I mean, they do big pushes where I live for this as well. There are so many programs out there for all the excuses that people are making for them because of their poverty. No, there's actually things that actually could have helped. If they made a choice to not try to hide from the system because they're hiding something really, again, our word of the day, abhorrent, and criminal and disgusting. Anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it blows my mind. I mean, I do wonder about how much of that way of thinking just continues to enable this kind of life.
You know, and this goes to such a thing we cover so much, you know, on all it takes is to solve so many problems throughout our country and throughout the world of all the money we pour into for the Band-Aids that we're putting on all these things later in life, and just the money in the court systems alone. If you just put some really basic grassroots, hit them when they're very, very young programs in place to save kids, teach good, healthy relationships and behaviors, and get them out of the generational stupid and unhealthy things, we could save the world. Things. Anyway.
It would help if we start putting some, you know, basic common sense laws in place, like no more teenage, like under 18 marriages. I know some places have them. A lot of them don't. A lot of them still are like, well, a parent can sign up. How about we just across the board as a society go, you know, if you're under 18, you probably should be getting married.
Right. No, period. No kids getting married. And
don't care. Don't care about your religion, your culture, your bullshit, your great grandma, your peepaw, your dumb bumblefuck uncle, whatever the fuck it is.
Dumb bumblefuck.
Just no, we're just not doing that. Well, my great peepaw and grandma got married at 16 back in 1999.
Or the Epsteins of the world saying, well, you know, back during the Middle Ages, you know, this is an acceptable age for someone to marry. And I'm like,
Jesus. Like in some of this shit, it's like they got married in the late 90s and we're already to the grandchildren. I'm like, how the fuck does that happen? Oh, you start having kids at 13. So you could have the grandkids right now doing that. And it's just repeating itself. Well, just fucking stop. How'd that work out well for all you? Not at all, did it? Oh, you're all living in poverty and it's horrible and everybody's making absolute shit choices because they're just repeating the cycle because they don't have more than a sixth grade education. Maybe it's time to say stop. Maybe, just maybe. if we actually truly give a shit about other human beings, which I don't think we actually do as a society. I think it's more so we care about ourselves and not wanting to feel icky. So we don't go down these roads and let everybody live, let live, and what the fuck.
And mental health issues as well, obviously.
Q Brooks and Dunn, only in America. All right. That's going to wrap up the program for today. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. I'm glad we solved the world's problems and everyone will follow these directives and the world will be better. It won't. Okay. We'll go see your thoughts there and we'll continue our conversations there. Until next time, for Todd, for Robin, I'm Tony. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.